Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
The last year has been a challenging one for not just this nation, but for the world. COVID-19, the coronavirus pandemic, has changed the lives of most of us and sadly ended the lives of more than a half million Americans. But it's also been a challenging year for police departments for so many reasons, from the pandemic to an outcry over police use of force to criminal justice reforms that some police officials say target them. This weekend, we're going to hear the police perspective from a chief with decades on the job. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. My guest this weekend is Thomas Weitzel. He is the chief of the Suburban Riverside Police Department. It's a job he's held for 13 years, but he's been with the department for 36 years. He literally worked his way up the ranks. This is a case of local guy makes good. He's from River Forest, attended Oak Park River Forest High School and Triton College, and he's had the respect of his fellow officers and more recently police chiefs from around Illinois. He's been active in police associations and is one of the voices representing chiefs on major issues. He's also about to retire, and we're going to talk about that a little later, too. Chief Weitzel has been a guest on this program before, and he's a voice heard frequently on this radio station. Thanks to COVID-19, we are socially distant. We're conducting this interview via Zoom, and Tom Weitzel, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to start with one of the tougher issues because it was making headlines this past week. It's what backers call the criminal justice reform bill that Governor Pritzker signed into law a couple of weeks ago. It does a lot of things, but among them, it phases out cash bail. It mandates body cameras for police officers, phasing them in for smaller departments, and it allows anonymous complaints of alleged misconduct against police officers. Chief Weitzel, the Association of Police Chiefs had problems with this legislation. There are a few issues that I want to talk about, but let me let you highlight what your biggest concerns are about this new law.
Well, I was actually very supportive of the law, and there's many, many parts of that legislation that I've supported from the beginning, such as the body cameras, a database for police officers that are, you know, deemed to not be worthy anymore of serving. There's no possible way we should be sending police officers throughout the United States from agency to agency that there isn't some way that we could track their work performance in other departments, because it wouldn't be right to have an officer that was dismissed in Illinois, for example, for a misconduct that didn't rise to the point of they were criminally charged, for example, and then that officer went to Wyoming and applied for a police position there, did not disclose that discretion that may have happened back in Illinois, and is hired without having all the facts. So I think that database is really good as long as it's fair and objective. And I mean, those pieces of the legislation I've always been in favor of for a standard use of force policy throughout the United States. I think that's a really important piece. And I think Illinois can lead in that perspective. I think some of the issues that Illinois chiefs have had, and myself too, is, you know, the cash bail, the elimination of cash bail. I think we just need to know how that's really going to work. I mean, is that going to be, there's no logistics set out to how we operate. Is that We're not bringing defendants or arrestees down to bond court anymore because there's only going to be certain crimes that judges in bond court will hear, or are all prisoners coming down to bond court and then the judge will decide if there's any cash bail or not? Those types of logistical points, which are very important to law enforcement, haven't been worked out. So, I mean, my preference would be that judges, that you would have to appear in front of a judge, especially if charged with a felony crime, and you would let an independent party determine on bail. And even if there is bail, and maybe no bail is appropriate on some more nonviolent crimes, but let a judge decide that and not just say no cash bail, period.
And the way I understand at least the intent behind it is that judges would decide each case, and frankly their choices would be either they stay in jail or they don't, but you don't set a dollar amount for how they would be able to get out. And the idea is that they're supposed to assess the person's risk, and that someone who's not a risk, at least this is how it's been explained to me and how I've heard it explained to other people, is that gives the judge the discretion to say, and measures to say, this person is a threat to people around them. Domestic violence cases are a good example of where this would be used. Or this person isn't a threat. They stole something from a store and they're not going to hurt anybody. But how do you feel about that? And frankly, they're going to be making up the rules as they go forward, hopefully bringing police chiefs in on it.
Well, making up the rules going forward is not a good idea. Bringing the police chiefs is, that's an excellent idea. And I'm all for, there are some people that should be released on their own recognizance, no doubt. And I'm hoping that there is some standardized risk assessment that form that can be used, taken into their criminal history. Have they ever jumped a bail before? You know, what is their family structure? You know, because if you have ties to the community, you're far less likely to flee or jump bond. So those are all common sense stuff I think that could be done. But you brought up one good point, the domestic violence cases. I mean, that's something very important because right now in Illinois, domestic violence is probably the only misdemeanor crime that the police officers have to keep you in custody and take you to bond court in the morning. The rest of the misdemeanor, retail thefts, batteries, those can all be released from the police department either by I bond or cash bond. So, I mean, domestic violence really has to be looked at because even right now, law enforcement agencies are not allowed to release those offenders.
And, like I said, my understanding is that the reason it's being phased in, or in fact, the effective date is somewhat down the road on that, is so that they can talk to all the parties and see, all right, what rules need to be in place when it does go into effect. Because I think people should know it's not going into effect tomorrow.
That's an excellent point, because the chiefs just want to be brought in and we want to sit at the table and be able to tell the policymakers, this is logistically how it works. This is what happens at 2 o'clock in the morning when an officer makes an arrest. And this is the process we have to go through to get individuals into our police custody, into bond court, transported to bond court. So let's talk about how the process is going to work. And is it even worth our time and effort to transport individuals to bond court that will be automatically released without bail? Because it's not going to be released on an I bond. It's either going to be bail or in custody or not in custody. So if there's a set of crimes that aren't in custody, they should let us know that ahead of time, because we shouldn't be transporting these individuals down to a bond court.
That's a good point. One of the other aspects of this is supposedly increased training for police officers. And you talked about the standards for use of force and that being a good thing. Is overall training or better training, better resource training, a good thing for officers as well?
Any training is good for police officers. And the more training we get, the better performance our officers deliver to the residents they're serving, no matter what community you're in. I always like to ask our legislators if they pass mandates for law enforcement that you also attach funding to that, because we have to pay for those training out of our own budget. And as you can imagine, the budgets are horrible during this pandemic time. And it's going to take us several years to recover from budget restraints we've had during the pandemic. I mean, you won't see police departments and municipalities come out of the COVID-19 era of limited budget funds probably till 2024, in my opinion.
I want to talk about one of the other big issues that came up last summer and could come up this summer too, and that's the issues of racial justice when it comes to policing. Obviously, some people in African American and Latinx neighborhoods, even in the suburbs, complain that they're over-policed, more likely to be stopped or pulled over, treated more harshly. First off, is do you feel that that criticism is fair? And second, how do we deal with it?
I think it's fair in some circumstances, yes. I think that there may be isolated incidents. Problem is that sometimes all law enforcement gets wiped with this big brush because of a highly publicized bad policing incident. And there are those. Those do exist, no question about it. But all law enforcement isn't like that. And could we see more of this in the future? I'm hoping that we as a profession are moving forward. I know my colleagues that are police executives, whether that be police chiefs, sheriffs, or superintendents, we've all talked about better policing, about key components. And one of the key components that all of my counterparts talk about is recruitment and retention. This all starts with recruitment of officers into the profession. And that includes a diverse workforce. But it also includes us reaching out to the minority communities, the minority colleges, advertising in the right place, and targeting more inclusion. So yeah, I think that that's something that we can move forward on and bring more people into our profession, because what I'm worried about is that some of the anti-police rhetoric that's been going around the nation will have good candidates that wanted to come into this profession that would not come into it otherwise today.
And that is also a good point. And let's talk about some of that that rhetoric. I mean, the outcry has been defund the police. And aside from the polarizing rhetoric itself, how do you feel that police are very often asked to handle some things that they maybe shouldn't have to or aren't trained or equipped to? And so, I mean, behind the rhetoric, is there not a kernel of reality that needs to be addressed as well?
Well, like I say, in my community in Riverside, there's tremendous residential and business support for public safety. They've always been a community that has supported police and fire services for that matter, but they've also always demanded accountability. So I have a really good community that supports public safety, but I also have residents that hold us accountable. That needs to be maybe a national model going forward. And I would say that defunding the police, that's really the wrong term. I think the term that should be used, in my opinion, is reallocating the police. Yes, there are, we need to look at delivering services different. And we are asked to do a lot in this environment of being the police, dealing with mental health services, counseling, juvenile matters. So we need to reallocate our services and say, this is what the police are going to do. This is the agencies we'll partner with in the future. Mental health services, homeless individuals, maybe service centers, hospitals, those types of organizations that can assist us. The key has always been, can we get organizations that can respond with us 24 hours a day? Do we have co-policing type of organizations that will come with us at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning when we're answering a well-being check? Somebody calls and an individual acting strange, wants the police to come to check on their well-being. do we have a mental health professional that can respond with us to help us in those situations, which would be a tremendous benefit. And I know of no chief that would turn down that type of assistance. It's always been a key of funding, and can we get organizations to partner with us, not just on normal business hours? Because you know that a lot of the more violent encounters we have and the more complicated encounters are not just Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. They happen all the time.
You're listening to News Radio 780's At Issue. I'm Craig Delamore. We're talking about the challenges of policing in these times and in the suburbs. My guest is Thomas Weitzel, the soon-to-retire chief of police in Riverside. I want to talk with you about the issue surrounding the issue we were just talking about. The ideas for maybe changing the way we police, but it comes in the midst of basically rhetorical battles that people kind of have retreated to different corners in this. And how do you move past the animosity that maybe exists in some communities that distrust the police because of some of those past bad actions? And in many cases, police who feel that they are viewed with hostility and unwelcome.
Yeah, well, we have to start with our residents or the people that we're serving. No doubt that there needs to be this exchange, and some of it might be uncomfortable. I've participated in some public forums since the unrest that took place over the summer with my own community, and some of it, residents have come and asked very poignant questions. They've demanded to see proof of training and compliance with issues. We need to have that conversation. But we also have to ask our residents now in policing, what do they really want from us? Because it happens every day in other government agencies. We routinely ask our residents, you know, where do you want us to spend the money on parks and recreation? Where do you want us to spend the money on public works? Do you want us to build walking paths? Do we have this amount of money? Would you like us to do tree planting, sidewalk replacement? Well, let's do the same in law enforcement. Let's ask our residents, what do you want to fund for us? What services do you want the officers to provide as a whole? And then, because we're serving you, so you need to give us the feedback, and then we need to have that open conversation to say, yeah, we can meet these demands. There's some state statutes that we have to comply with, but what do you expect? Because quite frankly, you're going to see different opinions of the way we should police in Riverside than the way that they should police in LA, for example, or maybe San Diego. I mean, there's where we're policing is where we need to conform to the community's expectations of us.
And how do you balance the different interests? Because when you and I have talked before, you're going to get a different response from, for example, the retailers in your area versus maybe people in some of the residential areas. Retailers obviously want to keep theft and things down, but other people may feel that maybe that's not the priority. Maybe it should be something else.
Yeah, that's going to be a balancing act. Some of that might have to be where we're going to put our resources, our dollars. Of course, we're going to respond. The police profession is based on calls for service. You call the police department, we'll respond. Over the years, that's grown into you call us for everything. I mean, so it's not just policing anymore. We're handling dog calls. We're handling animal calls. We're having well-being check, mental health issues, retail thefts. You know, there's a manhole cover missing in the roadway that somebody thinks is a hazard, a driving hazard. They're calling the police first. So we have to be wise about the resources we're using and saying, how do we do this? This has come a time to retool and say, we can't police like we did 40 and 50 years ago. First of all, the public is demanding that we change. And the law enforcement profession is a profession that serves the public no matter where we are. That's the core of what we do. So we really do have to look at that. And there might be a balancing act there.
Tell me how COVID-19 has challenged suburban departments like yours? I mean, has it been its own thing? And not just, you know, just layered on top of everything else that you have to deal with, or is it its own separate problem?
It's a huge issue. From late March of 2020, when the coronavirus was really raging throughout the United States and beyond, there isn't a single part of law enforcement that the pandemic has not hit. Staffing has been a huge problem. We ordered our officers to do less traffic enforcement, to have less contact with citizens if they could. We didn't go into homes. We asked them, the complainants, to come out into the sidewalk to meet officers, or to allow us to call back by phone so we could limit the contact of nonviolent responses. So if we had to respond because there was a crime taking place, you know, the officers had to wear their PPE. That was a whole new thing for our officers to get used to. And, you know, it's affected our budgets tremendously. And here's one thing that probably isn't highly publicized. It's affected retention of employees and recruitment. But also, even when we're slated to hire new officers during this pandemic, the police academies throughout the state of Illinois were shutting down. And we couldn't even get officers into basic recruit training to come to be part of our agency, because you couldn't put that many officers in training rooms or in barracks for 16 weeks of training for basic recruit training. So that whole process has been delayed by a year. So the whole hiring process and staffing process has been very, very difficult for us. We've had to put administrators back on the road. Detectives, plainclothes detectives, have gone back into street duty, all just so we can answer the calls of our residents. Mm.
Did you find much resistance to the requirements for PPE and stuff from among your own officers?
I didn't find resistance. I found confusion. They had never had to wear these gloves and sanitize their squad cars every day and wear what kind of masks should they wear? How do they communicate with somebody with their mask? What did we mean by limit contact with individuals? You know, what was the standard for that? They were worried that they would contract it at work and bring it home to their family. So, you know, we had to make sure we were dealing with the whole officer, and they brought it home, and could their wife contract it and kids contract it? Those were a lot of early on questions that we were all working through. I mean, I've been in this job 37 years, and this was by far the most difficult and complex year of policing I've ever experienced.
And, you know, which brings us to the other thing that we talked about at the top. So why leave a fun job like this?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, it's just, I've been in the job 37 years here in Riverside, and 13 as the police chief. And I worked for another agency before Riverside. So I've been in law enforcement for 39 years. It's always good to know, you know, it's time maybe for a new, fresh approach to come in, a new set of eyes. It's just time for change. I'm hoping that I can land something somewhere in the future. And, you know, maybe do something else in law enforcement for, you know, another 3 to 5 years. But it's always, you know, change is a good thing. And this is you have to know when to leave, and you have to know when it's time for others to move up into leadership positions and take over. And that's not a bad thing, because then you can get a new executive that can look at situations with a fresh approach, a new set of eyes. And I think that's always benefited our profession as a whole. I've never looked at the chief's job as being like, you see the politicians these days, sometimes they want to pass term limits. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're at a top position, it's good to have experience, but it's good to also not stay too long. If you kind of follow me on that.
Yeah, I do. And I mean, the impression I've gotten over the few years that we've known each other, has been that you really love your work. And so that, yeah, I can see it might be hard to leave, but I also see but you had the advantage when you got that job of having done every other job but that job when you got it. And so your chief saw you as the person to, do you have that kind of bench system going in the department now?
Yes, we have the village of Riverside as a whole has always had a very defined succession plan. It doesn't mean that that person will be named a department head, for example, but it means you put people in position to compete for those jobs. And that part of your job as a leader is to mentor those coming up behind you in all ranks, whether that be patrol, sergeant, you know, commanders, deputy chiefs, but to at least give them the groundwork, the education, the formal training, the command training, so that they compete for other jobs. I mean, I've always been proud that a lot of my leadership team over the years have gone on to be police chiefs in other suburban communities. So they've risen up through the ranks in the department. They've competed for jobs in other communities, and other communities have hired them as chief. I always thought that spoke well to the training environment and the command environment within my own agency. Like I said, Riverside is a wonderful community, beautiful community. It worked since I was 23 years old. I love the residents here. They've been very supportive. So it is bittersweet for me to retire from Riverside, but I'm hoping to stay active in law enforcement for several more years.
Well, I'm sure we do too, so we can call you. we want to hear your thoughts, but what's your biggest concern that you have as you look toward the future of policing and what policing is going through now and maybe changing into?
Is that this is an honorable profession, and we are recruiting people, and we get the message out that we want to be totally inclusive. We want a diverse workforce. We want compassionate, caring officers, but we have to get out there and let them know, let the general public know, we want you to come into this profession. You know, Craig, I have three sons. All three of my sons are police officers. I totally believe in law enforcement as an honorable profession, and we need to train and we need to bring anyone in who wants to. They need to compete for these jobs and come on. That's the only way, one of the biggest ways we can get back to support of the public is they see that we're inclusive. They see that this is a really honorable and good profession, and these are officers that generally want to serve the public.
I'm going to tell you a secret. I have one son. He's a police officer, not in this state, but he is. So there's some of that going around. What's the one thing, and we just have really about a minute or so left, the one thing that you feel too few people understand about policing that you need to make sure they see?
It's complex. The officers are wearing many different hats. They're doing tremendous amount of policing and non-policing that the profession was never intended to do. But as we evolve, we need to change now. So we need to either bring in different organizations to assist us in the non-criminal matters, or we have to start to focus on what our core services are so that we can deliver those to our residents in a more just and compassionate manner.
Do you think that the local governments are going to be able to see that need and fill it as well?
Yes, this is about shifting priorities. And if we're going to change, if we're going to make some significant historic change in core law enforcement, we need the funding. And I think that's where our elected officials come in. If they want us to head in these directions, I agree. I am totally in agreement. But give us the funding for it. And also bring the chiefs of police and the superintendents and the sheriffs to the table so we can help shape the path forward. And, I've never been one. I would sit at a table with other police chiefs, sheriffs, faith community-based community leaders, the ACLU. If they want to sit down, because in the end, we're not all going to agree. But in the end, we're going to come to some agreement. And there's going to be some conflict, and there's going to be some different ideas. But at the end of the day, there will be an agreement on whatever topic we're talking about. And that's what we want. And that's what the Illinois chiefs want. We want to be involved in the negotiations and the talks. We're not afraid to be involved in that. We embrace it.
Chief Tom Weitzel of Riverside, first off, best of luck in whatever you do after May when you do retire. And I want to thank him for spending this time with us. To our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or to hear it again, please visit our website at WBBMNewsRadio.com. You can also find our podcast on radio.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.